My thanks to Jeff Notkin there, first hour guest. And now we change gears a bit. You know, one thing our government is good at is saving paper records and documents and files, probably our emails and phone records as well, all kinds of records. And they're even better at classifying stuff. Seems like everyone who runs for president promises open government, you know, fewer secrets. And then they get elected and they classify as much stuff as they can. So much of our history is off limits, classified, stuck in archives somewhere where we can't read it. But what if we could learn a bit about our own secrets by peeking into the archives of other nations? Ray Waru did just that. He gained access to the national archives of his home country, New Zealand, and uncovered reams of fascinating, previously unknown stuff about the history of his country, but also about the history of ours as well. The book is titled Secrets and Treasures, and I can tell you it is packed with both. In a moment, Ray Waru joins us to tell us what he found. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Ray Waru has been involved in the television and radio industries for more than 30 years. He joined Television New Zealand back in 1977, has directed and produced a lot of local favorites and programs that have won international acclaim and awards. His new book, Secrets and Treasures, Stories Told Through the Objects of the Archives New Zealand, is a wonderful addition to any library. And Ray, we are really pleased to welcome you to Coast for your first time.
Hi, George. It's really fantastic being here. And you seem so close, even though we're a long way away from one another.
Long way away. I tell you, I read the book. I really enjoyed it. But I have to compliment you in another way, in that, you know, I deal with documents a lot in my line of work, and it's hard to make them look interesting. But this is a beautiful book, and the guy who did the photography did a heck of a job.
He did a great job, didn't he? But sometimes, even though you're looking at things that are bits of paper, that are old pieces of paper, they have a kind of beauty and magic and mystery all of their own, really. It's something that in the digital age we're going to have to do without.
You and I share an interest, of course, in researching things that are off limits sometimes, and digging up secrets from government files, national archives. We have in this country our Freedom of Information Act. You know, it was a good effort. There are a lot of exceptions, and it seems like our government, the more time goes on, the more unwilling they are to allow the public to see documents, files, things that should be public. Talk to me for a couple of minutes about what the attitudes of your government is like. And I ask it in this context. I was impressed that your book starts off with statements from your Minister of Internal Affairs and the Chief Archivist at your National Archives, both of whom at least talk a good game and saying that, you know, it's an indication of a strong society is that evidence of decisions and actions of government are open, that we allow our society to see this stuff. What is it like in terms of free flow of information in your country in general? And how was it for you? How hard was it for you to gain access to the archives that you got into?
Well, I think in New Zealand, there is a fairly open attitude to information, state information, information from local government. We have a Freedom of Information Act as well. It's a relatively straightforward procedure to get information about what governments have done and what city councils have done. Some of the material, though, is concealed. And recently, we started to believe that some of our secrets have actually been going to the United States. And in fact, if the U.S. government keeps some of your emails, we tend to think they keep some of ours as well. But in general, the attitude to open government and transparency and accountability for government here is actually quite important to New Zealanders, the way we kind of deal with governments, the way we deal with a state. We tend to think that because we're a small country, I suppose, we meet politicians all the time. Our politicians aren't as isolated, I think, as sometimes in the U.S. We have a prime minister who is much, much more approachable necessarily, I think, because there aren't, I suppose, the same kind of security issues around the president. But we're a small country, and sometimes we might seem a bit backward, but some of our attitudes to things like the freedom of information probably right up there on the cutting edge.
Let's go back to this statement you just made about Americans having some of your secrets. What do you mean by that? Meaning?
Well, there are a couple of, or there's at least one American-supported base here, which is part of an international network of, you would believe, eavesdropping facilities that record and collect email communications, telephonic communications, and other sorts of communications, and it's part of an international network, which was breached a couple of years ago by peace activists in New Zealand, and quite a lot of this information was exposed and revealed. But there's a general feeling that the New Zealand government, for all its attitude to openness and transparency, like a lot of governments around the world, I guess, kind of share secrets with governments that they don't share with their people.
Well, we'll get into some specifics maybe in the course of this evening's conversation. Why don't you tell us how this project started? Did you just go to the archives and pitch it to them? What did you say? And what did they say about what kind of access you could have? I mean, they don't just give you the key and say, go ahead, Ray, go ahead and look around, take whatever you want.
Well, in a kind of way, they did, really. I've been using archives for years and years for making documentaries, and for writing and doing stories for magazines and such like. But nobody had ever really kind of looked at the simple stories, I suppose, the stories that might interest ordinary New Zealanders, ordinary people who might not really know that there's such a huge trove of information and history that's just sitting there waiting to be explored and utilized and turned into books or academic material, or for ordinary people, their family trees. The New Zealand Archive is a tremendous resource for people who are just doing their own family histories. There's a huge amount of information about employment histories, education, work history, all sorts of things there, and people use access to the New Zealand Archive to kind of, you know, fill out the branches of their family tree and tell their own stories. So in general, Archives New Zealand was very open and eager, in fact, to have somebody come and look at the material that they've got there and to tell some of the hundreds of thousands of stories that are sitting there to be told. It was a huge opportunity. It was a daunting task when you kind of look at the hundreds of kilometers of shelving space and thousands of paper archives and films and photographs and books and all sorts of things that they've got there. It's a kind of a daunting task, but, you know, one story leads on to another, and eventually you kind of get a sense of what's there and you get a sense of the way that archives are history talking to you. There was an archivist in Canada said that state archives are the messages that one generation leaves for another. So archives are kind of, I suppose, how history talks to us, how the past talks to the present. And I thought that was an interesting thing. Because archives, the other interesting thing about archives really is that archives are in their original form. They're not like, archives aren't like art galleries or libraries. They're not something that somebody has, a painting that's an interpretation, or even a photograph in the kind of way that's an interpretation, or a book that somebody has written about, or a piece of fiction. Archives are documents in their original form. They are a document that you or I may have signed. They are a document that a prime minister or a minister of the crown or a king or a president might have signed. It's a formal letter between heads of state. These mostly state records are in the original form and they don't lie. And at some point in time, almost all archives are open for scrutiny and investigation. And that's history speaking directly to a later generation. And I thought that was an interesting thing. Time travel.
I don't know if you found any documents about time travel, but I would ask you about that for sure. What limits did you have, though? I mean, did they say, okay, come on in, take a look around, or did they say, you can't go into that room, you can't go into that file?
Well, there are documents that are still restricted because they are too new. Most documents have some kind of limit on the time that they can be restricted, and they can be as long as 100 years. Mostly they are 70 years, and sometimes they're a lot less. There are some documents that were restricted for privacy reasons, and there were some documents restricted because they were still covered by issues of national security and intelligence. But by and large, most of the documents were free. There were some things, though, that people at the archive themselves didn't actually want me to see, and you might talk about some of those later on. They were,
well, yeah, I was going to ask you, is there anything you found that they realized, oh, man, you shouldn't have seen that, and then they asked you, please don't go with that?
The first things that people got slightly edgy about were the human remains. There's not many, but the archives actually hold some human bones, which were part of coroner's inquiries. And it's not generally known that an archive, you know, has human remains. And people were a little sensitive about dealing with those or publicising those, really. There were a few other documents that are associated with a couple of famous murder trials that were restricted that we, you know, were able to poke about in. But mostly, there was reasonably open access to almost everything they had, I think, really.
And was there anything, as I mentioned, anything you found that they then later asked you, please don't go with that?
No, there wasn't, actually. I thought there might have been. Mostly they seem to have been sensitive about exhibits from murder trials that involved, you know, things like blood smears and stuff for some reason. But all the stuff that's on CSI nowadays. But no, there was at the end of the day, there was nothing in the book that they were not happy to have written about and to have the public see, really, I suppose.
Do you have a sense of the openness of your country as compared to our own? I just know that we classify so much. I mean, you talked about how your Freedom of Information Act works, and they're generally pretty open about it, but the amount of stuff that gets classified by your government for national security reasons, whatever.
Well, I guess, you know, for an ordinary citizen, it's actually hard to know a lot of that, isn't it?
Right.
It's like, you know, we don't know what we don't know.
Well, I'm just, you know, as a journalist, you know the kinds of material that get classified, and you're right. We don't know, even in this country, how much. We just know it's a lot.
Yes. And I think certainly since 9/11, almost all governments around the world really have had a much more inward-looking view about how they release information and what they consider to be important. We might talk a little bit later on about a guy in this country called Kim.com.
He's yes.
an internet
yes.
entrepreneur, and he just opened a new website yesterday, but he was arrested in New Zealand a year ago yesterday, and the general feeling is that our government was kowtowing completely to the wishes of the FBI and the US Justice Department. And since the man's arrest in a rather spectacular raid involving helicopters and real sort of, you know, action movie stuff, since the raid occurred, the government departments, one of our spy agencies, in a New Zealand court, it's been proved that, in fact, they broke the law and overrode the law in making the arrest and in executing the raid on Kim.com's property. In fact, because the general feeling is that we wanted to do it for the American government.
This guy, Kim.com, is he sort of like a Julian Assange guy? He puts a bunch of stuff online, like WikiLeaks?
He's a bit like a Julian Assange. He looks like, remember the actor John Candy?
Yes.
Well, he looks a bit like that. He's a strange man, really. He's only 38 years old, but he's 6'6", weighs over 300 pounds. And when his website was closed down a year ago, there was something like $100 million in his PayPal account. He'd set up a website that was called Mega Upload. That was a kind of file sharing site that allowed people to share movies and music, amongst other things. It had legitimate uses as well, because people could use it just as a file locker and as a, you know, a digital safe. But American authorities took down the site because they argued in an 82-page indictment that it was involved in copyright piracy and money laundering and a whole lot of other things. And then there was a spectacular raid on this $30 million mansion that this guy is renting in New Zealand, just north of Auckland. And helicopters and men with guns arrested him and finally found him cowering in the safe room with a shotgun. He's a kind of a colorful character, really.
Wow. Tell me this. We'll be going. I want to get into the tsunami bomb, but I don't want to do that before a break. Is the archives in one place, or you've got several different places where you'd have to go?
There are four. There are four offices. The main office is in our capital city, Wellington, and they have offices outside Wellington and Auckland and Christchurch and Dunedin. We're along skinny country, so you can imagine they've got offices spread from one end of the country to the other. And anybody is allowed to access them. And in fact, they encourage access. They're, in a kind of way, the poor cousin of kind of national libraries and national museums. They have this legislated function. They have a function under the law of the government to record and keep important papers. And the general feeling is that this is, you know, dull and dusty work. And it's not a kind of institution that immediately attracts the interest of lots of people. So it's an institution that a lot of people in New Zealand, in fact, really don't know a lot about.
Had anyone done anything at this level before, before you went?
No, they haven't done a book. And we'll probably be doing some more things coming out of it, because I didn't look at, there are quite a lot of things there, of course, in one book you can't cover everything, but I never covered, they have film collections, there's a very big film collection there, and a large collection of stills from various periods that I also didn't cover, so we're probably going to do some more things in the future. We also might do some special book for children. To show them that there's all sorts of interesting things there just for kids, really, I suppose, yeah.
I want to get into the tsunami bomb after this break that's coming up in 30 or 40 seconds or so, but I'm curious about what the reaction has been in your country. I saw the story. It went all over the world about the tsunami bomb, but have you made ripples in New Zealand with the book?
Well, there was quite a bit of interest, yes. It was something that people didn't expect. We've had anti-nuclear legislation since the 80s, and the very thought that New Zealand was developing its own weapon of mass destruction, I think, was something that came as a huge surprise to a lot of people. So, yes, there have been a few ripples, you might say, since Christmas, since the story went viral around the world just after the New Year.
Any secrets about hobbits? I mean, movie hobbits, at least, are based in New Zealand.
Based in New Zealand. I think they are spreading like a virus too. We used to have millions of sheep. Now I think we've got fewer sheep and more hobbits.
Well, that's worked out pretty well for your country. Yeah, worked out pretty well, hasn't it?
It's worked out extremely well. And the whole idea that, cinema work of such high quality could come out of a little country like New Zealand is almost as surprising as some of the things I found at the archives, I think.
Ray Waru, who's new. Ray Waru's new book, Secrets and Treasures, is a pleasure. We get into the tsunami bomb, UFOs, and much more to come here on Coast to Coast. We're talking with television producer Ray Waru, who's now an author. His new book, Secrets and Treasures, telling us about hidden jewels from inside the National Archives of his native country, New Zealand, and what they tell us about our own secrets, our own country. We'll continue the conversation right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Ray, I wanted to ask you before we jump back to the content of the book is how people can get it, because I don't know, I can't find a link for an American distributor. Do they have to order it from you down there and ship it overseas, or do you have somebody here who's selling it?
I don't think actually it's, the book is reasonably newly out in New Zealand. It was only released at the end of last year. The website, the Coast to Coast website today is showing the link for the book, which can be purchased online from a New Zealand-based online seller called Fishpond. And they sell books all over the world. It's not on Amazon yet, although I've tried to get our publisher to make it available to Amazon. But a link on the website should get you to fishpond.co.nz, and you can buy the book there.
Okay. Well, I think that you would have a pretty big audience here. This is... It's interesting stuff, and it covers a lot of the topics that are of interest to Coast to Coast. The big headline, of course, as I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, was about the tsunami bomb. Tell me about finding those documents. I mean, you hadn't heard about this before until you saw the paperwork in front of you, right?
No, I hadn't, actually. I mean, I don't think many people in New Zealand had actually heard much about it. And I came across it quite by chance when I came across a huge stack, like telephone books, of the report that was made of this really top secret World War II military project. These reports were still going through the vetting process at Archives New Zealand. Every single page had to be checked. And there were lots of copies of these reports, and there they were sitting there. The material has actually already been released, because it was released a few years ago by Archives New Zealand itself. But like a lot of military material and intelligence information, even though something is theoretically released, every single page has to be looked at and checked to make sure there's nothing that shouldn't be released. And there they were, all these copies of this report that was done in the 1950s of this quite extraordinary military project that occurred in the last years of World War II in New Zealand. The project was called Project Seal, and it was an experiment to make a bomb out of a tidal wave, to make a tsunami bomb. And I think after seeing the effects of the huge tsunami in the Indian Ocean in 2004 and along the coast of Japan in 2011, the very thought of trying to make a bomb that was a tsunami would just seem inhuman, I suppose, today. But that's what they were trying to do.
Well, describe what the document said. Describe what you saw in the documents, because from what I understand in reading the news accounts, I mean, they did conduct a test, right?
The tests went on for a few months. It was in two parts. It began innocently enough, really, when an American naval officer named Gibson observed that blasting operations to remove coral reefs when they were preparing Pacific Islands for military installations during the Second World War. He observed that sometimes explosions produced a much larger than expected wave, and he thought that this technique could be weaponized and they could turn it into a tsunami bomb that could devastate coastal military establishments and even coastal cities. So it began with some experiments in 1944 in the Pacific island of New Caledonia, and that involved the New Zealand government and observers from New Zealand universities. And that was the experiments in New Caledonia in February of 1944 were so successful that the U.S. Pacific Commander, the famous Admiral Bull Halsey, decided he wanted a more comprehensive program to be undertaken in New Zealand. and with the cooperation of New Zealand military chiefs, the US and New Zealand started to conduct these experiments beginning in 1944. And the odd thing is that they were conducted at a place just north of the coast, just north of Auckland. That is today one of Auckland's top holiday spots. And I think most people who are using their jet skis or taking in the sun on the sandy beaches at a place called Shakespeare Bay wouldn't have thought that, just off the coast a few years ago, there were as many as 4,000 experimental explosions that were aimed at producing this tsunami bomb. And as the program continued along, Halsey seemed to be really enthusiastic about it. I found a letter in the archives, and he says in a letter to the New Zealand Joint Chiefs of Staff that the results of these experiments, in my opinion, show that inundation in amphibious warfare has definite and far-reaching possibilities as an offensive weapon. So he was very gung-ho about whether or not they could actually develop a tsunami bomb. And they began the experiment on the 6th of June in 1944, and it went through until January in 1945. Most of the work was done by New Zealanders, but the US Navy provided ordnance and all the explosives, and New Zealand engineers who were given temporary military ranks did most of the experimental work down here.
But it worked. I mean, it worked, right?
Well, there's kind of differing views about this, really, I have to say. When you read the report certainly looks very enthusiastic and positive about how effective it was. And the New Zealand guy that was leading the research, a guy called Leach, actually said that he could inundate Wellington if he wanted to. Whether he could or not was never tried, thankfully. But the general feeling was that, in fact, and the impression you get from reading the report was that it, in fact, was could have been successful if it had been tried for real. One of the ways you can kind of appreciate that is that they began to conduct their research under a false assumption, because when they started it originally, there had been some British research about deep sea charges and how to produce a gas bubble underwater large enough to produce a wave. And the British thought that you needed a single large explosion that was laid deep in the water. And the experiments in the Hauraki Gulf in New Zealand worked out, in fact, that wasn't the case, that the way to produce a bomb was to create an array or a line of smaller explosions that were detonated in unison, but that were actually close to the surface. So they had, in fact, worked out what, in fact, was the correct method for producing a large enough wave. You would have needed quite a lot of explosive. They thought that an array of explosions that would have used about 2 tons of TNT, 8 kilometres off the shore. If that was detonated correctly, it would have produced a wave about 12 metres in height. So, I mean, that was quite a big wave, and it certainly would have done some damage if it had hit something on the shore.
Well, as you speculated in some of the media articles, that you speculated that, well, heck, if the atomic bomb had not worked, this might have. I mean, it could have been used for the invasion of Japan. If the timing had been earlier, it could have been used for, the invasion of Europe.
Yeah, I mean, clearly it was designed, although the report doesn't specify or doesn't talk about targeting at all, clearly it was intended as a way of preparing for the invasion of the Japanese home islands. I mean, tsunami are a cultural and geographic fact in Japan, and I'm sure that when the possibility of weaponizing a a tsunami-type explosion began to be investigated, that clearly was intended as a weapon that would be used against Japan to prepare the way for an invasion. The program came to an end in early 1945, came to an end before the war in Europe had ended and a long time before the war in Japan had ended. But the general feeling was that the Allies were probably sure at that stage that they were winning the war, and there were other priorities, other military priorities. On the other hand, when the material was released in New Zealand, there was an old-timer called Toby Lang, and he said that, this bomb was never going to work. So he argued that, in fact, it was closed down because they had discovered that it wasn't going to work at all. But that is certainly not the impression you get from reading the report. And, in fact, in 1948, after the war, there were some attempts to open up the research again and get it going again. So even though by that stage, of course, the effectiveness of the atomic bomb was then well known, there were still some thoughts about continuing Project Seal and seeing whether or not they could use the bomb to make tidal waves. There was one other interesting thing that came out of this research, and this touches on UFOs. Some years ago, recently, a guy called James Carrion from MUFON, from the Mutual UFO Network, suggested that possibly Project Seal was nothing more than a huge deception intended to deceive the Soviet Union into thinking that the US had something even bigger in its arsenal than an atomic bomb. And he suggested that it could have been used as a program to unmask spies or distract the Soviets into chasing, you know, a non-existent weapons program. No evidence for this, I'd have to say, has ever really been produced, and there was certainly nothing in Archive New Zealand material that I came across. But I suppose it's an interesting idea. But when you read the report, the people who wrote the report certainly thought that if you had a big enough bang, you'd make a big enough wave.
Well, it just seems to me, and I'm speculating, that a military program that has potential, that kind of potential, is not something they forget. And you'd have to wonder if it became classified, if it exists in some black world that we don't have access to. I know that our country has worked on weather modification schemes. There are stories about trying to institute technology that could start an earthquake. Even knowing that they were working on this many years ago, whether it succeeded or not, could raise speculation that, you know, every time there's a tsunami, did we cause it, you know?
Well, yes, I guess that's the case. And you never really know how much of these military programs that are actually still in operation. You don't know, you know, which parts of some kind of program might have been taken up somewhere else.
One thing that came out in some of the news coverage about the tsunami bomb story in your book is that it discussed the relationship between the U.S. and New Zealand. You know, in my reading of history, it seems like every time we get into a scrape, some international force, that New Zealanders are right there as an ally of the U.S., fighting and dying and bleeding. But there have been strains in that relationship, in part because of nuclear issues, right? And I know you touched on that in some of the documents you found in the archives.
Yes, that's true. I think by and large, right throughout our history, really, we felt a close affinity with the United States, I suppose, because you'd once been a colony, and so had we. And you had a revolution a long time before the New Zealand colony got going. And I think in all the wars, and even now we had people in Vietnam, and we've got SAS troops in Afghanistan, New Zealand has rallied really very quickly to causes where the United States and Britain, of course, for us, have had to engage, and we've engaged freely and readily, really. The only strain came And it's a strain that's really still not completely resolved. It was in the late 80s when New Zealand decided it wanted to be nuclear free. We had worries about nuclear weapons, and then we had worries about nuclear power. And in 1987, we enacted legislation that made New Zealand nuclear power and nuclear arms free country. And that meant that a military relationship between the United States, Australia, and New Zealand called the ANZUS Pact was dissolved, and New Zealand was no longer part of that. And since 1987, up until very, very recently, the New Zealand military hasn't shared intelligence with the United States. Our military forces haven't exercised together, even though we sent troops to Afghanistan, and I think we sent troops into Iraq as well. But that's now the warmth between the two countries in the military area is now starting to be reignited again. But only recently, I think at the end of last year, there was a joint military exercise which freely involved New Zealand ships in Hawaii, but for some reason, the New Zealand ships that attended that exercise weren't allowed to berth at Pearl Harbor, and they had to find another berth somewhere else on the island. So even though the friendship was warming, at some point anyway, there was still some kind of interruption there. But our Prime Minister and President Obama have become great mates, really. And before our nuclear-free legislation, I do it in the book. Our Prime Minister, named Robert Muldoon, was very, very good friends with Reagan.
Yeah, you got some great documents in there about that friendship. Sure.
I was really surprised to come across a letter from the President of the United States to a Prime Minister of New Zealand that was headed Dear Rob, and signed Ron.
Well, I really enjoyed reading that. It just seemed to me, and I'm speaking from, out of left field, but that there is a great affinity between Americans and New Zealanders, and whether that applies to our government at all times, I don't know, but I don't know how New Zealanders look at Americans now, whether they feel like we push our weight around or whether they view us in general as friends.
I think there's a difference between Americans and governments.
Yes.
I think you'd probably say that most New Zealanders have absolutely no inhibitions at all about seeing the American people as their friends and companions and really similar in lots of ways. But when you start talking about governments doing things between themselves and for their own reasons, you sometimes feel that the populations are let out. But by and large, New Zealand has assimilated American culture for a long, long time, whereas Facebook ready and is American movie ready and television ready as any country on earth, really. And in fact, up until I suppose the 50s and 60s and 70s, when young New Zealanders did their overseas experience, it was to London. But since then, it's become really New York. So, America figures much more prominently in the minds of young New Zealanders, I think now, as a kind of place to see cultural experience because of our English heritage and our English colonial background, I suppose, and the fact that most immigrants and most immigration to New Zealand came from the United Kingdom and the British Isles and parts of the British Commonwealth. We used to think of kind of London as home, I suppose. But nowadays, young people are looking to America and lots of people are going for their overseas experience to look for temporary jobs and education and things in the U.S.
Well, I can tell you that there's a lot of warmth on this end toward the folks of New Zealand, and I know that you have many American tourists. I want to ask you when we come back about whether Americans move to New Zealand, and then we get into some of the UFO secrets that you uncovered. Our conversation with Ray Walru, author of the new book Secrets and Treasures, continues after this on Coast to Coast AM.